Welcome to This Is Money Show, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost. Here alongside Simon and I is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And on the agenda today, as the Tories say a £1 billion hello to the DUP, they wave goodbye to some key manifesto pledges, including getting rid of the pensions triple lock. But how sustainable is it? Could political meddling be impacting our decision to take advantage of the pension freedoms? And with more than 200,000 savers planning to cash in their final salary pensions this year, should you join them? Also today, do you care how much your fund manager charges? A big salary, an expensive holiday and a Porsche? Say you should. Talking of supercars, we ask who on earth would spend hundreds of thousands of pounds on a car? And as the humble cash machine celebrates 50 years, we consider with the rise of contactless and mobile banking, will it survive another half a century? All that and plenty more coming up. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the mobile app. But first, are interest rates finally about to go up? The pound jumped nearly 1% after the governor of the Bank of England suggested they could rise if business investment grows. That's despite evidence to suggest inflation is starting to impact how much we're going out and spending.
Capital overhang looks set to be eliminated over the course of the next few years. So if companies want to expand, they're going to need to invest, particularly in a tightening labor market. The strengthening global economy should tempt them to do so, particularly since UK companies are generally competitive given the fall in sterling. We have a broad-based recovery. Our estimate is more than three-quarters of the global economy is growing above potential, and we're seeing the circumstances in place for some rotation from consumption to investment, or at least the indicators. And if those stronger investment intentions are realized globally, there is the prospect of the global equilibrium interest rate rising somewhat, making a given monetary policy setting more accommodative. Now, in the UK, as I mentioned, there are a series of uncertainties that are pushing the other way. Uncertainties about how consumers will adjust to a period of weaker real income growth, uncertainty about market access post-Brexit, and uncertainty about the potentials in the transition to new arrangements with the EU and the rest of the world. And so the best thing we can do is to pursue the right policies as the bank within clear frameworks to promote monetary and financial stability.
Don't head to the bookies just yet, though. It was only last week Mark Carney said now is not yet the time to begin raising interest rates, which remain at a record low of 0.25%. He's also been having a pop at the banks this week, accusing them of being complacent and forgetting the lessons of the financial crisis. One could question whether they learned them in the first place. Just what damage, though, could this boom in car loans and the amount of debt we've been piling on our credit cards do to ourselves and the wider economy? So, Simon, Lee, a warm welcome to you both. Lots from the Bank of England this week, including the Financial Stability Report. We've got a couple of reports coming up. Can't wait. Lee, it's going to fall to you first. Financial Stability Report. What is it? What came out of it? Why should we care?
It's a report that is massively concerning, I think, to the Bank of England. The real doom-laden set of figures showing that we're getting more in debt, especially car finance. Car finance is absolutely going through the roof. They're worried about credit card debt. They're worried. They had a massive part about mortgages and the moves that they made a couple of years ago to make sure that we didn't have another financial crisis. But are these measures working? It was full of beautiful graphs. I mean, yeah. The amount of graph level of detail in that was unbelievable. It was like absolute graph excitement in there. It was fantastic. But Mr. Carney's been a busy boy this week, hasn't he?
He has indeed. He's been speaking quite a lot. I'd say the graphs and the infographics on that. It broke it down really nicely into really accessible viewing of what is essentially the Financial Stability Report. But what is it, Simon? Like, what is the point of it? Why do they bring it out? How often do they bring it out? And is it as worrying as Lee says?
I think that the point of the Financial Stability Report is meant to be not to scare the bejesus out of us, but to reassure us.
Right, Lee's done a really good job of not doing that.
Yes, which leads to the question of, is the Financial Stability Report working in its purpose? I mean, it's not explicit. You know, it doesn't say the Financial Stability Report is aimed at not scaring the bejesus out of you. It says a lot of jargon about what it's about. But what it's about is basically the Bank of England reassuring us that it's got its eye on things that could make us financially unstable. And if we cast our mind back to the credit crunch, the financial crisis, the subprime mortgage boom, the vast quantity of banks around the world slicing, dicing and then gambling on people in America who had never had a job,
yeah,
and were unlikely to ever be able to repay their mortgage. One of the defining features of that is that nobody actually appeared to be paying any attention to any of the risks that were going on,
yeah,
apart from the small number of people in hedge funds who made huge sums of money. Watch The Big Short if, yeah, you want to find out about that. So the financial stability report is directly linked to the new style of regulation, the new style of watchdoggery, the new style of central banking, which essentially is, we're watching, we're keeping an eye on things, we're going to head off any problems at the pass. And in this one, as Lee said, they talked about car finance. Interestingly, the concerns over car finance doesn't actually involve the people borrowing the money to buy the cars. Mm. It mainly involves the banks lending the money to the car companies to lend to the people to buy the cars, and the car companies, which have basically got colossal finance arms. In fact, some of the car companies are now a small car company attached to a large finance arm. And the problem is that basically people buy these cars on personal contract plans, PCP deals, and they are given a guaranteed future value of the car. There's worries that the value of secondhand cars is falling. What's going to happen is when they come to trade in their car, they've been given a, say, for example, a guaranteed future value of 10 grand. The car's only worth 8 grand. The car company's going to have to honour that, and it's going to be left with a car that isn't worth 10 grand, it's worth 8 grand. And all of a sudden you start to get a hole blown in people's finances. And then if you want to, again, cast your mind back to the credit crunch, the knock-on effect of that can be substantial. That's how we see financial crises develop. They develop from something that can seem relatively small to begin with, and then get much, much bigger. The other thing, as Lee said, is they're keeping their eye on the housing market, and mortgages in particular. And what they've said is that the measures that they brought in are working to head off any potential problems in the housing market, but they are keeping a close eye on it in case any potential problems arise. Although there are some of us who would suggest that there are already serious problems in the housing market, largely related to the price of houses.
Goodness knows. Stick your fingers in your ears. La, 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 la. He did actually say, though, look, the economy's doing all right. Nothing to worry about here. We're, yeah, just, as Simon said, we're just pointing it out here. But this culture of debt that we keep talking about, Leela, what on earth can we do to almost reset? Can we?
I think it's very difficult now, Georgie, because there's a lot of people that have, you know, quite a lot of debt that's been building up over the years. You know, we've spoken numerous times in the past about things like 0% credit cards. You know, people are just sort of shifting around debt, and I wonder how much people really sort of chipping away at the debt they've got. And, you know, wages haven't been going up particularly fast. A lot of people are struggling to get by and are, you know, don't have the capabilities to pay back some of this debt. And going back to car finance, I find it really interesting. There's a lot of sort of advertisements and things, and you look at it, and some of the deals are just absolutely incredible. And it does lure people in who might not necessarily would have thought about getting a brand new car in the past into getting one of these deals. You know, some of these deals are like £149 per month for a brand new, you know, Fiat 500 or something along those lines. And people, I wonder how much people are getting explained inside car dealerships that, you know, how PCP works and these guaranteed values. And would these people necessarily have been buying new cars in the past? But of course, what it does is it makes figures for, you know, things like the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders. It makes for good reading because we're having, you know, boom in car, you know, manufacturing. People are buying more brand new cars, and we're seeing that as a good thing. But people are starting to treat it almost like a mobile phone contract. Mm. You know, they're just going, well, 149 quid. You know, you have to pay a bit of a deposit, usually like £1,000 or something. But it's starting to snowball out of control, and I think that is the biggest concern.
I'm just surprised about it. I don't drive, so for me it's not really an issue, and let's be honest, if I did buy a car, I wouldn't really bother about getting a decent one. Mm. So I'm just surprised about the fact that it is such a concern. The Bank of England are raising it as an issue, but it also highlights as well how individual units, individual car dealers are clearly not going to be thinking about the impact this might have on the wider economy.
Mm.
So how do you get them to start being more responsible?
Well, in answer to what Lee's question of, you know, he wonders about how much people in the dealers know about what they're actually selling, I know the answer to this, and that is a lot of them, not a lot, they're car salesmen.
They know very little about this.
The car industry, to be fair, has been doing an awful lot of work in the background to try and dramatically upskill the people working in its dealers so that they actually know what they're talking about in terms of the finance things. But the problem is that this is an environment where it is very, very open to potentially salesmen who don't really know what they're talking about, customers who don't really understand what they're getting into, and a little bit of bending the rules on both sides between the customers bigging up how much money they've got coming in every month and the salesman playing down the risks and things like that, because ultimately their job is to get cars out the doors, and the car companies make money by selling cars in volume. They sell, you know, they're actually, new cars are fairly low margin products unless they're really posh premium cars. And so basically their job is to get tons of cars out the door, and there's all kinds of tricks they use to do this, like something we've written about before, the pre-registering of cars, where they actually register the cars to themselves. So if you're in an environment where car dealers are sometimes end up selling the cars to themselves to pre-register them just to show up in the figures, then you can see how in a finance environment things can come a bit awry. And stuff has been tightened up, but still I think that there is a concern. And ultimately, someone walks into a car dealership and they want a car. If someone says to them, well, you could get this car and it'd be £149 a month, but if you wanted this car, you could pay £179 a month. Could you afford the extra 30 quid? This car's much better. And they were like, well, yeah, I probably could afford an extra 30 quid. And then it's like, now, do you want the extras? And the extras on a car, you should see how much money the optional extras can add to a car.
So some Wait, of the, what are you talking about?
Okay, some of the cars we get in on test for our motoring section, the actual on-the-road price of the car, and bear in mind, car manufacturers, when they send journalists cars, send them pretty much fully spec'd out. They want you to think their car is absolutely amazing.
Journalists so get sent cars? Just to be clear about this, what? You get sent cars?
Well,
you have to
test them
back, presumably. Yeah,
to review them, to road
them
test
wrong
them. You get sent
industry,
cars,
my friend. Yeah,
cars that's been sent
to review. We run a very, very popular motoring section as well as a financial website, and we do review cars, and we get cars in on test. They tend to be very, very highly spec'd. But that can turn a £30,000 car into a £50,000 car. Mm. You look at the spec sheet that you get sent and you think, how on earth has 20 grand's worth of options been added to this car? And you look down it and you think, there's not even anything on there that's that expensive. The most expensive thing you probably find on that sheet is maybe something that cost an extra grand and a half. And you think, how'd you get to 20 grand? But then once you add it all up, it's substantial. But if you go into the dealership and you buy that car, right, and you get all these options added to it, but the cost is broken down over 36 months, and bear in mind with these contracts, you're not paying the cost of the car. You don't own the car at the end. If you want to buy the car, you have to pay a final payment. This is where this balloon payment and guaranteed future value comes into. All you're doing is paying for the depreciation in the car, the predicted depreciation in the car over those 3 years. So actually, once you take that extra 5, 10, 15, 20 grand's worth of options on top of the car and break it down like that, it might only add 50 or £100 to the cost of the PCP deal. And people think, yeah, all right, I'll do that. Because people think about how much can I afford every month, not how much is this thing actually costing me. And as Lee said, it's very much akin to the mobile phone kind of scenario where you don't own the car. And people do this repeatedly. They just don't ever end up owning the car. But behind this colossal like finance industry has been built up to basically get cars rolling out of factories and onto people's driveways. And that's the concern with the Financial Stability Report. It's a big concern in the US as well. So that's what they're talking about there.
Also, though, I suppose in this Brexit era Britain, the car sales have been touted as a positive news story, that we're still going, we're still producing all these cars.
Yeah, and especially high-end cars, you know, they're very much sought after across the world. But in terms of the UK, you're right, it really has been one of the positive stories of the last 24 or 36 months, where new car sales were really down in the doldrums. That's why the scrappage scheme came out, and that was a sort of real boost for the industry. And actually, I find it a real shame now, because I remember, you know, about 10 years ago, you used to see such a variety of like old cars. They used to quite like it. But, you know, at the same time, cars have got way more safer than what they used to be. But people are still buying new cars, you know, even with Brexit uncertain. And as you say, it's been spun as a positive news story. But if, I think something like 90% of car finance at the moment is PCP. And I think that is what's getting all the alarms going.
We'll come back to high-end cars a little bit later on. But I do want to come a little bit full circle on what Mark Carney was saying, or not indeed. Because we did see, didn't we, Simon, the pound jumping nearly 1% after he suggested interest rates could rise if business investment grows. The pound may have jumped. I imagine a lot of people who've borrowed may be jumping out of their skin in sort of a bit of concern. But likelihood... It's our favourite game again, isn't it? Like, when are interest rates going to go up?
Yes. Well, we've had a particularly brilliant bout of the game of when are interest rates going to go up over the last couple of weeks. So, basically, 2 weeks ago, regular podcast listeners will remember that as we were recording this podcast, the news came out that the Bank of England had shockingly held the base rate at 0.25% again. But what had happened is three people had voted for a rise, which out of an eight-man MPC committee, or eight man and woman, means we were only theoretically one vote away from rates going up. And that's because a certain Mr. Carney, as the governor of the Bank of England, if it's split 4-4, has the casting vote. However, you cannot think of a more unlikely candidate to vote for interest rates going up than Mr. Carney, who definitely seems to be in the lower for longer camp and has had his tent firmly parked with a trench dug round it and an armchair outside it.
So why is that, though? Is it economic philosophy? Or is he just because of past performance?
Everything he said has basically been this indication. No, no, we're going to play it safe. We're going to play it cautious and everything like that. It's all been read as basically Mark Carney doesn't want to put up interest rates. So it's unlikely you were going to get four votes with him having the casting vote. And one of those people who voted for a rise, Kristen Forbes, is now leaving at the end of June. So you'd need three more members to vote for a rise if Carney doesn't, plus the existing two to get a rise. But it's now been suggested on the back of that that maybe that could happen. In fact, Japanese bank Nomura said it thought rates could rise as soon as August, which is interesting because basically in a Reuters poll at the start of the month, of 50 economists, not a single one thought the rates were going to go up this year. But we had this scenario, and then Mark Carney came out and gave a speech, his Mansion House speech, when he said now was not the time, you know, to be raising rates, and played it cool. And then the next day, Andy Haldane, the chief economist of the Bank of England, came out and said, well, actually, maybe we do need to be thinking about unwinding some of the stimulus from last August after Brexit, which, i.e. raising interest rates. So I was like, ooh, hang on a minute, is he joining the rate rise camp? So then it was split. And then we had Mr. Carney then come out this week and give a speech which appeared to be in slight contrast to the one that he'd given last week, where he said, oh, actually, yeah, we might need to think about raising interest rates. So everyone is a bit confused. And the thing I like to think about is, do you remember that thing called forward guidance?
I knew you could say that.
Well, apparently, you know, that worked and is still working, but who knows?
Remind us, what was forward guidance?
Forward guidance was a policy that strangely involved telling people what they were going to do with interest rates, or giving a very set framework so everyone would understand, removing one of the weapons in the central banker's armory, which is basically surprise, the weapon of surprise. And it stuck around for a bit, and then unemployment fell much, much faster than everybody thought it was going to, and seems to have been ditched. But when Mr. Carney was asked whether it had been ditched, he said no, it hadn't been ditched. It had actually worked, and it was still continuing. This was some time back. I don't know where we stand on forward guidance at the moment, whether we're still meant to be in the forward guidance regime or not. All I know is that basically the chances of interest rates going up this year seem to be substantially higher than they were 1 month ago. And I said 2 weeks ago that I think there is a possibility they could go up this year to 0.5%, where they will then stick again for a very, very long time.
All right, then. Thank you very much, Simon. But I just want to talk about, Lee, I'm going to come to you on this one, our little plastic friends. Happy birthday, happy 50th to the hole in the wall. But with contactless cards, mobile bank transfers and cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin, it beggars the question, will the humble cash machine live to see another 50 years? And I'm also wondering, Lee, whether it's had a part to play, contactless mobile bank transfers, in the amount of debt that we're taking on, that ease of spending. So what are your thoughts?
I think, firstly, I don't think a cash machine or cash is going to die out. You know, people like to have physical money. You know, I think what we've got is a vast choice, you know, not just in this country, but worldwide. If you want to pay some things with cash, some things by card. This argument that, you know, there's a lot of spurious sort of companies out there with vetted interests saying, oh, cash is going to die. Right, I just don't think it's true.
Curious, like who would be?
Well, no, I'm not going to start naming names, but you know, like providers that, you know, might make cards. You know, it works in their interest to say that cash is dying out. And I think people like a combination of ways to pay. Contactless, yeah, it has been a good thing, but it is easy to start spending a lot of money when you're not keeping tabs on what you're doing. Now, some banks, you get instant, you know, on your app where you're spending, and you can budget on there. But actually, I do think there is something better about budgeting with cash, because you know exactly where you stand with it. You know exactly how much you've got to spend. And I'm sure there's lots of people out there that still like to spend cash. And yeah, you're right, over 50 years this week, which actually feels incredible, doesn't it? 50 years of cash machine. It just feels like we take it for granted. Yeah. There's thousands of them. And we just, I don't know, it's just amazing to think it's the 50-year anniversary. And Money Mail, our sister publication last week, did 50 facts about cash machines that
give
you might never know. My favourite one, I'm just going to give you one, and okay. I don't know where this myth comes from, but it was definitely one I picked out and was like, do people really think that? That's ingenious. Is that if you were at a cash point and you were getting robbed, or someone was taking you to a cash point and you wanted to alert the police, apparently people thought you could type in your PIN number backwards and it would alert the police, which is a complete myth. Was that, where the hell has that come from? Why have people thought that for so many years? And how did it make this round up? But it made me smile.
What a clever idea, though.
It is quite a clever idea. Well, I don't know how it would work in principle.
It is a clever idea, except I remember being told this many years ago and immediately seeing the flaw in this, which is, what if your PIN number happens to be a palindrome, i.e. it is the same forwards as it is backwards?
Then it's not a strong enough PIN number, Simon. You
make sure that you are.
That's true. But when you get the thing that says to set your PIN, it doesn't say, don't make sure it isn't the same forwards as backwards, because if you put it in backwards, Batman will come.
So, Simon, what do you reckon? Money in or out in the next 50 years?
I think we're still going to have cash machines. What, you think cash, that's going to be around for a long time to come. Mm. I mean, the convenience of not having cash is wonderful. I don't know how much cash I've got in my pocket, but I doubt it's very much. But I think people do like cash, and also people don't like the sort of authoritarian meddling of the idea of a world without cash. You can start doing things like, you could have negative interest rates, things like that, that are much harder to impose on people in a world of cash, because you can basically just take your cash out of the bank and then at least it retains its value.
And also with all the cyber hacking stories at the moment, Lee, it's worrying. I'm thinking, you know, Terminator and Skynet here.
Well, this is it. Yeah, and that's kind of the view of a lot of our readers, to be honest with you, Georgie. I think, you know, people are worried about the cyber threat. And we've covered scams and fraud for years. You know, it's a real threat. We get constant people saying, oh, money's safer under a mattress, which, you know, I'm not going to say if that's safer or not. But people just love cash. And there's some transactions that people like to make that don't have a trial. And I'm not saying that, you know, anything illegal by that. But, you know, there's certain things that I like to pay with cash. If I like to have a flutter, for instance, at the bookies, you know, let's say Grand National or Ascot or something, I'd much rather bet in cash rather than the bank knowing that I'm going into bookies and they might think I'm a bit of a gambler, then they might think I'm a bit of a credit risk. And then, you know, if I'm reapplying for a mortgage, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I just think cash wins.
Also, we do get a steady stream of questions from readers about coins that might
That's
have
true.
A misprint on them, that might be worth more money.
What
my queen's
do?
Got a beard on the 2p.
Lee, that'd be
things
half
like
your
that.
Job gone,
we have
friend.
The £5 note with the serial number that's worth more.
We've got a new
more.
£10 note coming out this year.
You know,
so
we've
those
got
people
all
with
these,
a vested interest,
all,
yeah,
all
Lee.
These things, okay. No one, as far as I'm aware, has ever written into us and said, my debit card has got a picture of the Queen with a beard on it. Is it worth loads of money?
If you have got one, please do send it in.
Lee Boyce. And okay, so we'll put that to one side, because this week we got the true cost, didn't we, of Theresa May's gamble to hold a general election. The deal with the Democratic Unionist Party will see the government hand over £1 billion, or at least 10 Cristiano Ronaldos, as one MP really usefully pointed out, and the scrapping of a number of key manifesto promises.
We have reached an agreement with the Conservative Party on support for government in Parliament. As part of our policy agreement, both parties have agreed that there will be no change to the pensions triple lock, and the universal nature of the winter fuel payment across the United Kingdom.
In return, the Tories have enough support now to get key legislation through Parliament. So firstly, I know this isn't a politics show, but it is all related. So just, Simon, if you would, just what does this deal mean? It's not a coalition, is it?
Yes, it's a support agreement. They've agreed to support the government in a number of things involving Brexit, finance bills and things like that. I am absolutely loving the concept of paying them in 10 Cristiano Ronaldo's day. I'm wondering how you could achieve that, obviously, as there is only one Cristiano Ronaldo.
Well,
but I do like
twins,
the idea
the
that you might consider that as a way of being paid for something as a country, because if you had 10 Cristiano Ronaldos in your football team, you just need to add one goalkeeper and you could potentially win the World Cup.
And the money that would bring in, you know, people would come back to the pubs, they'd watch the sport,
exactly,
wouldn't they? They'd
exactly
care about exactly English
exactly
football.
Exactly, but more sensible matters. The money will be invested into the Northern Irish economy on things like improving infrastructure and things like that. The argument against this has been that actually per capita, Northern Ireland already sees more public spending than any of the other British Isles nations. In return for this, they will give their support to various things, but also there was a couple of things negotiated as part of this that have dropped out of things that the government's going to do, one of which is the dropping of the triple lock for state pensions. So that looks like it's going to stay for some time. It was meant to stay until 2020 anyway, I think, but obviously the next election takes us to 2022. And the means testing of winter fuel payments, which means that people like Alan Sugar will have to find other ways to dispose of winter fuel payments that they don't need and have tried to stop the government giving to them and have basically been told just give it to charity, which is not the most efficient way of doing anything. But the idea of means testing this benefit has proved to be very unpopular amongst many people, even though an awful lot of people who don't need it get the winter fuel allowance.
Lee, just one word about the state triple lock. It does stay, as Simon said, but look, everybody's coming out. We can't afford this.
It's a very pricey looking sort of initiative now, if you look at it, and so, you know, you have said it's going to be reviewed in 2020, so you know they just want to ditch it so much. It's difficult, isn't it, because you give a big portion of the population something as generous as that, but if you then take it away from them, they're obviously going to get upset, and you know it's going to go up by a minimum of 2.5% state pension until at least 2020. It might even go up by more than that, seeing as inflation's going up. The Tories just can't get rid of it.
It has been,
honestly, this whole deal and everything, it's just been absolutely crazy. And there's just so much confusion around at the moment in all aspects of politics, not just, you know, things that are financial based. I just don't know if anyone really quite knows what's going on.
Well, that's an interesting point that Lee makes, because actually your pensions correspondent, Tanya Jeffrey, she's been busy, hasn't she, this week? But one of the stories on your website is asking, should you take your 25% tax-free pension lump sum? And our fears that the government could axe it justified. So there's more about government interference in pensions. And I know we've spoken about this in the past, Simon, but it does impact on what people do. If you don't know that the government's going to stop meddling around with it.
Yes, and I mean, something like the 25% tax-free lump sum is hugely popular, and people base, you know, quite a substantial amount of their retirement planning around it. To axe that would be hugely controversial. I would find it a highly unlikely scenario that would be got rid of, certainly by this government, but, you know, who knows? When Jeremy Corbyn's prime minister, you never know with these things, and I think this is why we need to try and get some kind of cross-party agreement on pensions as to this is what it's going to look like, this is what we're going to do, and some way of enshrining it that means that it can't constantly get meddled with, because we've meddled a lot with pensions in recent years. Some of that meddling has made the pensions landscape better, it's made it more flexible. There are concerns that people might run out of money with the new pension freedoms, but I think overall, if you've trusted people to save responsibly through their life for their pension, then you can trust them to spend it responsibly in their retirement. But we need to stop messing around with this stuff. And things around the edges, like the annual allowance, the lifetime allowance, any suggestions to do with cutting tax relief or cutting the 25% tax-free lump sum, they really don't help people have any trust in saving for their retirement.
I wonder as well whether you think it would be useful having a pensions minister that lasts longer than 11 months. We've got a new one. Wouldn't it be lovely to have someone sort of in the job, a bit like Steve Webb, your pensions agony uncle, that can really, really understand the brief?
You could say that about a number of roles.
Yeah, that's true.
But you're right. I mean, it does need a long-term minister that's got, you know, best interests at heart. It's going to really take, you know, the mantle with it and really run with it and actually, you know, really give some stability in pensions and housing. I think they're two really key areas that there's a lot of concern over at the moment. And, you know, if you keep chopping and changing the minister, it's like pensions is a very in-depth subject and you've really got to sort of read up and learn about it and really get involved in it. And I wonder how much, you know, these ministers are really throwing themselves into the deep end looking at pensions. If you had someone like, I like Steve Webb a lot, but, you know, someone had a couple of years run. But it just seems like no one can stick it out.
Well, I mean, we had that expert, that independent expert with a depth of knowledge, come in, you know, after Steve Webb.
Ross.
You know, Steve Webb lost his job ultimately because he was voted out as an MP.
Yeah, that's true, it's true.
And then Baroness Altman, Ros Altman, was brought in, but she didn't last much more than a year. I don't, was it a year? I'm not sure, yeah. I can't remember.
Wasn't that her
and
choice,
she fell out with the government, and that was to do, you know, with some of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes, talk of what George Osborne wanted to do with pensions. You know, it's very difficult to work out what you do about this scenario, but to go back to the 25% tax-free lump sum thing, according to Aegon, 54% of workers plan to take a tax-free lump sum at retirement, which actually is less than I would have thought. I would have thought more people did it. And the issue is that if you take the tax-free lump sum, you're left with less money in your pot. So if you've got a defined benefit pension, a final salary pension, and you take the tax-free lump sum, and it will reduce that sum. So say, whereas previously your pension might have paid you £15,000 a year, take the 25% and it might only pay you £12,000 a year, for example. These figures are not correct, by the way. I'm making them up off the top of my head as an example. So you've got to make that decision between, you know, jam today, jam tomorrow. Do I keep that steady income coming in, or do I take the cash in my hand? And people like the idea of the cash in their hand. If you have a defined contribution pension where you have a pot of, you know, say £100,000 that you've built up over your lifetime, then it's really obvious what happens if you take the 25% tax-free lump sum out of it. You're left with the rest of the money minus the 25%, and you've then got to use that as your pension. So, and what do people use this on? Well, Aegon said that basically 17% plan to put it in a cash ISA, 15% will stash it in a bank account, 14% will take a holiday, 12% are thinking about buying a property, presumably using it as a deposit to buy a property because you'd need a very big tax-free lump sum to buy a whole property, and 10% intend to clear debts. And so some of these things, you know, were fine. I mean, there is a scenario where it's totally fine to take this money and spend it on yourself, improving your home, going on a holiday, getting a new car or something like that. It's fine as well to think about buying a property if you've weighed everything up carefully. It's fine to clear debts as well if you've got debts that you need to clear. There is a risk, though, in taking this money and then just sticking it in the bank and not spending it, which is what an awful lot of people do, is that if you left this money in your pension, it could continue to grow and continue to benefit from investment growth, or it could be providing you with a higher income every year. And instead, what happens a lot of the time is people go, oh yeah, 25% tax-free lump sum, sounds good, take it and put it in a bank account, where, as we know, they are earning absolutely zero, pretty much, on their savings at the moment. So people's behaviour is causing them to lose out.
I wonder if it goes back to the mentality of cash.
Yeah,
having
it's
cash
nice to have a
available.
Chunk of
you were shaking
available.
Your head there, though, Lee. What
shaking,
were you shaking your head about?
I was shaking my head that I couldn't believe that number one was cash ISAs. I was like, wow, that really...
With the rates at the moment,
that,
amazing.
That really surprised me. The only thing I could think of is if you've got quite a big cash ISA pot that you've built up over allowances over the years, then it may be beneficial for you to top up your cash. But I'm still surprised by that answer. I'm massively surprised by
that
answer.
Realistically, if you don't need that money in the short to medium term and need to spend that money, then probably you're better off keeping it invested, unless you think you're some wizard at market timing and the stock market's going to fall. Because at least by keeping it invested, you can try and keep it growing over time. Then comes down to this length of time as to when you might need it. I.e., if you need it in 2 years to pay for something, you need all that money, put that money in cash where it's safe. But if you don't, and it's just money that's just there, even if you want to take that tax-free lump sum, you're probably better off reinvesting it into an investing ISA than just sticking it in a cash ISA that might be earning you 1%. You're going to be losing money, you know, on that after inflation.
I'm just curious, though, because you said leave it invested, but, you know, what happens if, and you don't know, what happens if in a couple of years you get poorly and you need that money quickly and you don't want to be caught on the wrong side of a stock market, say, downturn? So you always say you're in it for the long term, but actually, what if at that age, surely you should be lowering your risk a little
bit?
That
is true, but we do have a safety net in this country. We have the NHS. You know, we do theoretically have some form of social care system that looks after people. This is why you need to think about this properly rather than just tick the box that says, yeah, I'll take that money. And why actually it is worth people taking financial advice when it comes to making their decisions about what they're going to do with this pension money they've got to live on for the rest of their lives. Because there'll be all kinds of things that you don't think about and all kinds of things that human behaviour tempts you to do or your own outlook on life tempts you to do that might not actually be the right thing for you. And you might think, oh, I can sort this all out myself. But in fact, in many instances, you know, when you talk to financial advisors about stuff around retirement planning and stuff, the things they start talking about are the kinds of questions that you wouldn't even think to ask yourself. Yeah, it's probably going to cost you a couple of grand to get that financial advice, but it might be a couple of grand very well spent.
All right, talking about spending money on financial advisors with regard to pension, one more story. Well done, Tanya. But if you are lucky enough to have a final salary pension, why on earth would you look to transfer out? Often called gold-plated, they pay you a set retirement income depending on how long you've worked and how much you've earned rather than how much you put away. And yet cashing in is what over 200,000 people are planning to do this year. Many companies offering enormous cash sums for you to switch to a plan that is linked to the stock market. But why and does it make sense too? First of all, give a little bit more of an explanation than I just did there, Simon. What exactly a final salary pension is? Do they exist anymore? Is anyone giving them out?
There's not many companies where you can continue to build up a final salary pension left, but there are an awful lot of companies that have promised people who previously worked for them or who currently do a final salary pension. And a final salary pension is a bit of a catch-all term that's given to what is actually a defined benefit pension. It's a bit Ron Seal. It does exactly what it says on the tin. The benefit that you are going to get is defined. So your company, for example, has promised to pay you 1/60th of your final salary, so your salary on your date of retirement, which traditionally should be the highest amount of money that you earn at that company, 1/60th of that for every year that you've worked for them. So, for example, were you to work for that company for 30 years, you would end up with a final salary pension that was worth half of your final salary. If you work for them 40 years, it would be 2/3 and so on. And there's different accrual rates, but that's the general description. Now, the great thing about this, the company has made this promise. The company is bound to this promise unless it goes bust. And even then, there are some quite complicated rules surrounding what it has to do. And it can't renege on it. And so you have got what is known as a gold-plated pension because it's up to them to meet your pension requirements. Now, if you compare that to the more modern defined contribution pension, which is where the contributions that go in are defined, so you pay some money in, your employer pays some money in, you build up an investment pot, and at the end of it, it's up to you to turn that into an income, and you are dependent upon how the stock market performs while you're invested, what bond yields are, and all these other things to do with the financial markets for how much money you might get in the end from your pension. So, for example, people who retired with a defined contribution pension since the financial crisis have been absolutely hammered by the fact that annuity rates are on the floor because annuity rates are linked to government bond rates, and government bond rates are on the floor because interest rates are on the floor. So you look at these two things and it's clearly obvious which one of those is better. The defined benefit pension, the final salary pension, that's a really good thing. Now, these are really expensive for companies to service because basically these promises were made many years ago when interest rates were much higher. So with the same sum of money, you could provide a much greater income to people. Or if you look at it the other way, if you'd promised someone an income of £10,000 a year, it cost you much less then than it does now. When stock market returns were much higher, so money that they had set aside to be invested into that pot for their employees was going up and up and up and up, so they could make these generous promises. And when the pension was a badge of honour for companies, they would try and recruit people off the back of this. It would be, we'll pay you this much, we'll give you this company car, and we've got this pension scheme, and it's cracking. I think nowadays it's just, we'll just pay you this much, no car, no pension, or a small defined contribution pension.
Yeah, exactly.
However much the government are telling us to pay at any given moment. So they've got these huge liabilities. Companies are looking at this and saying, this is causing us problems. We've got to channel a huge amount of money into this. We can't afford this. Doesn't look like things are going to change any time in the future, and these liabilities are going to get any smaller. Maybe we could pay some people out of these schemes. Maybe we could say to, you know, working Joe over there, hey, you know that pension we promised you? Well, at current rates, it'd be worth £20,000 a year to you in retirement. How about we give you a big lump sum instead, buy you out of it?
And
you
some just, of these are huge,
and
right?
You move into a defined contribution scheme. Because if you, unless you are, I'm not sure of the exact rules, actually, whether you've already retired, whether they can just give you cash. But basically, they have to put it into another pension. You can't just take the cash kind of thing. And some of these sums are huge. Traditionally, the value of a defined benefit has been worked out as 20 times what you would get as your annual income. So, for example, in the scenario where your annual income would be £20,000, the pot would be judged to be worth £400,000. But actually, the companies are offering people way more than this. I've heard of people being offered £1 million, £1.5 million, £2 million to pay them out of their pensions. And the temptation there is, like, if my company is offering me 30 times, 40 times even the amount of what this is worth to me, I'd have to live a really long time to get all that money back. So say, for example, you retired at 65. Are you going to live another 40 years? Or should you take the money in your hand that would cover it off? And people think, well, I could probably pay to live for another 40 years on that kind of thing. And then there are other advantages, as in if it's in a pension, you can pass it on to your descendants, inheritance tax free, and things like that. And so you've got people with some of these pensions looking at them, especially if they've got like a small chunk of it, but even if it's their main pension, looking at this and being very, very tempted to take the money. And up until now, the financial advice industry has been largely very, very much against this. And a lot of advisors basically say we won't touch it. But because of the big sums being offered to people, because people actually do want to do this, but they can't do it without taking advice, some of the advisors are saying, well, hang on a minute, maybe in some instances it would be easy for people. And the government are changing the rules a little bit around this, a technicality. But you're going to see more of this. And for some people, I was talking to someone at work the other day who's got a final salary pension from another company, and he said, well, I quite fancy, you know, retiring early. And if I can get that money, then that would make a big difference, you know, because I'll be able to draw on it, whereas I wouldn't be able to draw on it through the actual final salary scheme. And then also there was a scenario where someone said to me, I think my company might go bust. Or I think my
BHS
company...
BHS is the big example
I think my company might go bust. Or I think my company might try and wriggle out, go bust when it's not really bust and wriggle out of what it owes people. So maybe I'd be better with the cold, hard cash in my hands, so to speak. So that's why people are doing it.
I suppose if you've got health issues as well, just to keep it cheery, but that might be worth thinking about. But the, some of this, as to everything, when we talk about these pensions, is get proper advice.
Right? Mm. And also, if a company wants to buy you out of something by basically paying you a massive price to get you out of it, you need to think long and hard about how valuable that thing they're trying to buy you out of is. Because generally speaking, if someone's willing to pay you a high price for something, that means it's a really good thing and it might be worth holding on to.
All right, Simon, you've not quite finished yet. Now, as the Financial Conduct Authority's catchily titled Asset Management Market Study Final Report, I did promise we'd have another report, landed with an almighty thud this week, the watchdog has been probing the UK's $7 trillion asset management industry in an effort to increase transparency and lower costs for investors. Will the recommendations work? And does anyone even care what their fund charges? Well, Simon, in your blog this week, you argue maybe we should. Explain.
Well, we should care. And this is one of these things that we spend an awful lot of time telling people about. Fees matter because fees eat into your investment. And over the long term, the difference between paying 0.5% and 1% can be tens of thousands of pounds on your investments. But I do wonder whether people actually care. They're just not that bothered. I think it's to do with the way the fees are structured. It's to do with the jargon. Mm. It's to do with the fact that we get regular reports on this and talk about things changing. It's to do with the fact that the FCA's report is 114 pages long and all of these other things. But ultimately, you know, when people get told you're going to get charged 1.5% on your investments, they think, well, 1.5%, it's not that bad, is it? Doesn't sound like that much. Doesn't, does it?
But it's 1.5%
doesn't sound like that much.
It doesn't mean anything unless you give it to people in money terms.
But it's on all of your investments for a start, right? Okay, so it's not just the money that you put in that year. I mean, it's on all of your investments and the growth that you get from them. It's on everything in that pot. And if you take everybody's 1.5% and you add them all together, you get a lot of money. And one of the indicators of this lot of money is the huge amount of money that the fund management industry makes and the huge amount of money that those who work in the fund management industry make. There is a famous line alleged to have been said by a visitor to New York many years ago who saw all the boats in the harbour, and he said, whose boats are those? And I said, oh, that's all the brokers' boats, you know, the stockbrokers and things like that. And he's like, where are the customers' yachts? And if you updated that for the modern day Britain, it would be, where are the customers' Porsches and big houses in Surrey? Unless you earn a couple of £100,000 a year, you should care about investment fees, because many people in the fund management industry will be earning much more money than you unless you earn that.
But won't they argue that they deserve that?
Well, they do argue that they deserve that. But really, can an industry that enriches its participants, enriches its players so much more than its customers, justify that they deserve that? Because ultimately, all of that money that is being paid in astonishingly high wages to the people who work in the industry could either be going to cut fees or improve returns for investors, which is effectively the same thing. My argument was that you should care about this. There's a Porsche that they might have that you don't have. There's a big house that they might have that you don't have. And there's also an expensive holiday. Basically, if you invest £300 a year for 25 years and you get a 7% return on average, at the end of it, the difference between a 0.5% fee and a 1% fee, I calculated, is about £13,600, I think it was. That's pretty much a round-the-world trip for two. So why pay for your fund manager to go on holiday when you could go on holiday yourself? That's why you should look at the fees.
Fair question. But it's interesting you talk about Porsches, Simon, in your blog, because I'm going to talk about expensive cars. You have a number of stories on your website. Aston Martin unveiling its electric supercar. Mm-hmm. Jaguar bringing out its most powerful vehicle ever, apparently. Mm-hmm. Ferrari F40, once owned by Pink Floyd's Dave Gilmour and Elton John's Nikita Bentley, being sold at the same auction for, I imagine, a heck of a lot of money. Aston Martin, $230,000. The Jaguar, $150,000. Which begs the question, why would you ever spend hundreds of thousands of pounds on a car like this? Is it just overpaid asset managers and footballers?
Well, look, at the end of the day, if you've got the money to spend and you like it, you buy it. You know, what's the problem with that? I mean, if people have got that kind of cash to blow on a toy like that, then go for it. You know, us mere mortals, George, we could just dream about wind flowing in our hair in a £230,000 electric Aston Martin.
I wouldn't dream of that. Do you know what, Lee? I wouldn't dream of the £230,000. I would appreciate it.
There's a good story up today, actually, that our motor correspondent Rob's done about a 1956 Aston Martin DBR1, which could be the most expensive British car ever auctioned off.
It's how much?
It's between $15-20 million. £1 million. People just love this stuff, George. You know, if you're a car enthusiast and you've got the kind of cash to do this, why not? And I was talking to Simon about this earlier. My friend bought a classic car, not quite a six-figure sum, but bought an old Beetle for about £8,000 3 years ago. He didn't do any work to it. It was all nicely done up. Similar spec, same year. He's looked at now 3 years later, and it's pretty much tripled in value.
Don't get me wrong. Classics, I think, are absolutely fine. Mm. I'm one of these people that thinks artwork, it depends, you know, how much you value it. If that's what you value, that's fair enough. The new ones for, like, you know, 230 quid, yeah, I wish. 230,000 or whatever. And the ones with the land, which is the one which had the star constellation on the top. I've never let
Rolls Royce.
Oh, yeah. Ridiculous. Yeah. What is the point in those?
Oh, it's fantastic, George, because when you sort of sit back in that car and you look at the stars and the constellation, which they can custom to any day.
Amazing.
But say your birth. You think, this is, when I was born, this was the constellations in the sky. It's amazing. Look, people who have, you know, billionaires have the money to spend on it, you know, and that's what they like to spend the money on. So who are we to criticise if they like it?
Simon?
Scarcity. Rarity. You're paying for rarity. You know, Rolls-Royce don't make many cars every year. I mean, with Rolls-Royce, you're paying for luxury, heritage, you're paying for basically the best car that money can buy, but you're also paying for the fact that it takes them an awful long time to make these cars. So there's a lot of craftsmanship that goes into it, but they still make lots of money on them. But it is scarcity. That's why you're paying for. And with the Jaguar, the XE SV Project 8, this 200-mile-an-hour four-door saloon, it's based on the Jaguar XE saloon, which is basically the baby Jag. But this is, you know, going to be a £150,000 car, but they are only going to make 300 of them. And so if there's only 300 of something in an environment where you've got people chasing expensive cars, then you can work on the basis that it's probably going to go up in value, or it's not going to go down in value very fast. And there are examples of cars, particularly the Porsche 911R recently, which basically they made a very, very limited number of them. They said, we're not going to make any more of them. And people who bought those cars, effectively a brand new car for £150,000-ish, I think, they've now got a car worth like £600,000-£700,000. There are some new cars that are so rare, if you can buy one, they just go straight up in value. But any market like this, whether you are talking about Lee's friend's Beetle or 150,000 very limited edition Jaguar, you've got to bear in mind that it's purely based on sentiment. And sentiment can change very rapidly. It's the same. The same is true for cars, as it is for art, as it is for wine, as it is for many other things that people buy because they are rare and scarce. Moods change, prices can fall.
They do indeed. But I want to ask you about this and move it onto perhaps safer ground for me. I nod along sagely when you talk about cars, but I'll be honest with you, Simon, I have no idea what you're talking about. But is it Is it best, a bit like Star Wars figures, to keep them in the original box? Or do you... Stop laughing at me. Or do you, can you go out and drive these cars? It's fine. It's fine. Do you know what I mean? Can you take it out of the box?
I'm not aware whether Jaguar will deliver the car in a box. We can ask them. I'm sure, actually, that if you paid Jaguar enough money, sure they'd be happy to deliver the car in a box for you. So, yes, actually, if you look at the cars that go up in value the most or are considered the rarest, they are the ones that hardly ever turn a wheel, that don't have many miles put on them. But there is also still a healthy disregard for that in the car world, where there are people who do what they should do, and they go out and they buy these cars and they drive these cars and they make sure that they are driven and that miles are put on the clock, and they say, hey, yeah, that might, you know, reduce its value. But cars are there to be driven. Cars are not built as a work of art to be looked at. Cars are built, are created as a piece of craftsmanship to be driven. So, you know.
Like Star Wars figures are there to
Star
be played
Wars,
with.
Star Wars figures are there to be played with. Yeah, I mean, imagine that. So you were given all these Star Wars figures as a kid and you just kept them in the box.
What
and
sort
you didn't
of kid
play
would you
with them?
Be if you went, no, in about 40 years' time, but, these
I mean,
are going to really...
Do you blame the... Can you blame the parents? Is it the parents' fault? I mean, what kind of parent are you? Here you go, son. I've got your Han Solo, Luke Skywalker and the Millennium Falcon. They're staying in the box and they're going in the loft.
Exactly. Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk.